So we will take up where we left off. I'm thinking just because this last section of what happens after you've attained the ninth stage of sustained attention, what goes on there? It's quite important, the sequence. So I think I might just read all of that again, because I know you all studied it so hard and remember and understood. And so, excuse that I'm being redundant. No, you're looking at me like, Okay. So let's petition the three jewels to teach you again, and go over this material because it comes up again in the upcoming section. And the upcoming section is very interesting, very technical, can be confusing. Yeah, you're shaking your head. You read ahead, huh? Yeah. Confusing, huh?
Yes.
Yes, but we'll get it all unconfused. But I should tell you that when I was writing that section, I was confused, and I was, looking in different books. I talked to S.K. Venerable Thangka Khajo. She was looking up things. I talked to Geshe-la. Finally, kind of, I think we got it straightened out, but it was quite technical. Yeah. Okay. So that makes imagining the merit field and us surrounded by all sentient beings very easy in comparison. So we can see by regarding our mind on a day-to-day basis how much it's like a wild monkey or a wild elephant running here and there, thinking about this and that. So this practice of developing serenity is very helpful in calming all of that. Of course, our habit to have that monkey mind is quite strong. So it's a slow, dedicated practice to tame it. But if we're as we're able to tame it and the mind gets quieter, more able to stay on an object with clearer perception, the more that increases, the more when we meditate on the determination to be free, meditate on any of the bodhicitta meditations, and also emptiness, then all of those meditations become easier to really stay with the object and also to investigate the object. So imagine what it would be like to develop serenity on the four immeasurables and even on bodhicitta. So you could place your mind on any of those and really infiltrate your mind with love and compassion and the altruistic intention devoted to benefiting others. And that would certainly make it very, so much easier to practice the six perfections because we would really want to, because we have this affection and closeness to each and every sentient being. So for imagine for a moment what that might be like, and let's use our aspiration to actually transform the mind, to make it like that as our motivation tonight. So we're very stuck on what do other people think about me? And that kind of thought comes up a lot, doesn't it? Do these people like me or they don't like me? Do they approve of what I'm doing? Are they mad at me? Do they think I'm stupid? Do they think I'm negligent? Yeah, do they respect me? Do I belong? Am I included? Yeah. And going round and around about me, I, my, and mine, especially, you know, what do they think of me? As if that is the most important thing that's happening in the country today. What other people think about me. Yeah. Kind of ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, what other people think about us? Are you ever going to be able to really get a good sense of that? Can you go into anybody else's mind and digitize their thoughts so that you can take that home with you, review their thoughts, and conclude whether they think you're a good person or whether they don't like you? You can't do that, can you? Yeah. So when what do people think about me, it's us guessing what they think about us. It's guesswork, isn't it? Yeah. Are we very good at understanding other people's minds and what they think of us and why they think that way? I don't think so good at that, yeah? So maybe we shouldn't worry about what other people think about us so much, because we can never really know. Yeah, even if they took a poll, yeah, in the Abbey, a daily poll, yeah, 9 o'clock in the morning, what does everybody think about me? Do you think that by 10 o'clock, if they polled everybody, it would have the same results as at 9 o'clock? No. Yeah. And at 11 o'clock, it would probably be different again. Yeah. So maybe instead of worrying so much about what other people think about me, we should be more concerned with how do I see others? Yeah. Not how do I feel about others? Because then we could so easily get into our discrimination things. Yeah. But how do I see others? Do I see them as kind? Do I see them with eyes of respect, with eyes of understanding? Yeah. How do I look at others? Because this is so crucial, you know? Do we look at others with our mundane, judging, you know, mind that says, I like this and I don't like that. Why do they do this and why do they do that? Or do we look at them as, you know, here's people who want to be happy, who don't want to suffer, who are so much influenced by their previous karma, their present afflictions. Yeah, they want happiness, but they have no clue what the causes of it are. And in fact, they're not really clear what happiness is. Yeah, because they collect all these things and all these experiences, thinking it's happiness, and they feel let down at the end of the day. Yeah. So how am I looking at others? Yeah, with eyes of kindness, eyes of understanding, or eyes of judgment. And of course, the judgment is all, do they fit my little chart of good qualities, or my big chart of undesirable qualities? Yeah. So keep turning it back on what's going on with me. Okay. So let's go back to page 101. We'll start at the bottom there with what a song. 201. Yeah, I was close. I got the 01 part. What do you want from me? 2 out of 3. I thought it was pretty good, huh? Okay, so let's start with Asanga's quotation. What is pliancy? So remember, pliancy is one of the 8 antidotes to the 5 faults. Okay, what is pliancy? It is a serviceability of the body and mind due to the cessation of the continuum of physical and mental dysfunctions. It functions to dispel all obstructions. So physical dysfunctions, we can't sit still, something hurts, I want to get up, I need to cough, okay? And mental dysfunction, yeah, I'm in such a bad mood today. Oh, is that you? Yeah? Oh, wow. Okay. Both of you. Okay, physical dysfunctions are factors related to the winds, or prana, or chi, in the body that make the body heavy and uncomfortable when we try to engage in virtue. Yeah, oh, I want to engage in virtue today, but I'm so tired. I just woke up. I'm no good when I wake up. You know, it takes me about 8-10 hours to wake up, and, you know, and by that time I'm tired. Okay. Mental dysfunctions prevent taking delight in eradicating afflictions. Oh, but my afflictions, my attachment is important because it makes me happy when I fulfill it. And my anger is important because it protects me from everything that is threatening my attachment and me getting what I want. So, what does it mean, mental dysfunctions prevent taking delight in eradicating afflictions? I want to nourish my afflictions. Yeah. And I've seen people say, I remember one time a conference with Stephen Levine, and one young man got up to ask questions. And he was like so tight. He said, "My therapist said I was abused and that I should be angry. And I'm really trying to be angry." It's like, yeah, no, I don't think that's Venerable Jigme would not approve of therapists, kind of doing that kind of trip. But, he wanted to be angry. Okay, through increased familiarity with concentration, physical dysfunctions are overcome. At this time, the brain feels heavy, though not in an uncomfortable way, and there is a pleasant tingly sensation at the top of the head, as if a warm hand were placed on the crown after our head was freshly shaved. This sensation occurs as dysfunctional winds leave from the crown of your head. Okay. Immediately afterwards, because the dysfunctional winds have left, the dysfunctional mental states are overcome and mental pliancy is attained. So, first, mental pliancy. Okay. In general, mental pliancy is a mental factor that accompanies all virtuous minds and enables the mind to be directed towards a virtuous object. However, at this point in generating serenity, this is a special mental pliancy that is a serviceability of mind, a lightness and clarity of mind, coupled with the ability to set the mind on whatever virtuous object we want. Okay? So if the mind is serviceable, we want to meditate on a certain object, we can put our mind on that object. Yeah? And the mind cooperates and we're happy to do it. Yeah? The mind no longer resists being directed towards virtuous objects and is happy to meditate and stay on the meditation object. So you don't need to drag yourself to the cushion. You don't need to encourage yourself and say, "Oh, I should." No, because the mind is just happy and does this smoothly, because it wants to. Mental pliancy in turn induces serviceability of the winds flowing through the body because the winds that power afflictions have subsided. A wind of physical pliancy pervades the entire body, and the body's lack of serviceability for meditation is overcome. So, this is physical pliancy. First, we had mental pliancy, now physical pliancy. When that wind flows through the body, it's a lightness, buoyancy, and serviceability of the body that enables the body to be used for whatever virtuous purpose we wish without pain, fatigue, or hardship. Yeah, or having to take, drugs to keep awake or drugs to calm your mind or anything. The mind and body are pliant. The body feels as light as a cotton ball, almost as if we could ride on our own shoulders. Okay, so mental pliancy, physical pliancy, okay, then physical pliancy immediately leads to the experiencing the bliss of physical pliancy, which is a very blissful tactile sensation. Tactile means, you know, anything to do with your physical body, the sensation. The body feels incredibly comfortable and fresh, and we can use it in virtuous activities as we wish. Wouldn't that be nice? Your knees don't hurt, your back doesn't hurt. Yeah, the tick bites don't itch. As concentration continues, there is the sense that the body has melted into the meditation object. At this point, the bliss of mental pliancy is experienced. So it was mental pliancy, physical pliancy, the bliss of physical pliancy, then the bliss of mental pliancy. Okay? The mind is very joyous, almost too buoyant, and we feel as if we could focus on each atom of the wall. Following this, there is a sensation on the top of the head, similar to placing a cool hand on top of a freshly shaven head, and the mental bliss decreases a little. When it becomes stable, yeah, so it's not going up and down so much, unfluctuating bliss of concentration and unfluctuating mental pliancy arise. Two more terms, okay? Unfluctuating bliss of concentration and unfluctuating mental pliancy arise. At this point, serenity is attained. Okay. So serenity is concentration arisen from meditation, so not arisen specifically from hearing or thinking, but here from meditation, that is accompanied by the bliss of mental and physical pliancy, in which the mind abides effortlessly without fluctuation for as long as we wish on whatever object it has been placed. Wouldn't that be nice? Stabilizing meditation has been brought to fulfillment. Yeah, because the mind can find its object and stay on the object. There's no problem. Okay. So here, Kamala Shila says, for you who have cultivated serenity in this way, when your body and mind become pliant and you have mastery over your mind and directing it as you wish, at that time, know that you have accomplished serenity. So this is where we got to last time. So many signs occur with the attainment of serenity. The body and mind are flexible and serviceable. Physical and mental pliancy arise quickly when we meditate. The mind is very spacious and can abide firmly and steadily on its meditation object. Even a loud sound will not interfere with concentration. And your mind is not ruminating about, do people like me? Do people not like me? Do I fit in? Did I pass the test? Why did they get the promotion but I didn't? There's none of that. Okay, there is a sense of great clarity, as if we could count atoms. In post-meditation time, afflictions don't arise as often or as strongly, okay? And craving for sense pleasures has decreased. Okay, so the serenity is when you're in meditation. Yeah, so you're not walking around, you're not cooking, you're not, you know, doing motorcycle maintenance. Yeah, you're sitting in meditation. Yeah. When you get up from your meditation, okay, then you have to use your senses again. Yeah, you can't just, you know, be in in serenity in between sessions, because, you know, you have to look where you're going. And if you want to make a cup of tea and you need to move your body and you need to see what the temperature of the water and so on, know where the cups are. Yeah. So you have to use your senses. So you don't have single-pointedness at that point. Okay. But your mind is certainly smoother than it usually is. Yeah. Okay. So the mind, in post-meditation time, afflictions don't arise as often or as strongly, and craving for sense pleasures has decreased. But afflictions can still arise because you have single-pointedness on your object of meditation when you're sitting in meditation position. But when you come out of meditation, you're using your senses again. Your mental consciousness is forming opinions and thinking about things. So it's very easy for afflictions that we are familiar with to arise, okay? Not as easy as if we don't have a serenity, yeah. But they can still arise, yeah. And we certainly haven't obliterated them from the mind stream at all, because we haven't necessarily even begun meditating on emptiness. Okay, so we can meditate as long as we wish without any discomfort. The body feels light and at ease, and the mind is free from the five hindrances. Wow, free from sense desire. This is temporary because they've been suppressed, you know. But wow, sleep can easily be transformed into meditation, and wonderful experiences may occur during sleep. You have really nice dreams, yeah. Even after arising from meditation, some degree of physical and mental pliancy remain. Afflictions may arise in break times, but in general, they are weaker and can be easily subdued. So due to our familiarity with the afflictions, they can arise, but we can easily notice them, apply the antidote, and they, you know, are subdued, again, temporarily. Yeah. So serenity has three qualities. Yeah. First one is called non-conceptuality. And this isn't the usual meaning of when we say non-conceptual, okay? So it gets described here. So non-conceptuality, one of the first quality of serenity, is a non-discursive stability, the stability that comes with the absence of distracting thoughts. Okay, so here the distracting thoughts are all conceptual minds, because you're thinking about this, imagining that, remembering the other thing, all conceptual minds. So non-conceptuality here means that you're free from those kind of minds. Okay, it doesn't mean you have direct perception on something, yeah. So in this context, non-conceptuality does not mean that the mind perceives its object directly without the medium of a conceptual appearance. Okay, it doesn't mean direct perception, because usually serenity, many, depending on what you are, your object of focus is, yeah, it can be a conceptual object, yeah. So that, you know, it's a not conceptual object. It's a conceptual appearance, okay? Like you have, for example, if you're developing serenity on the Buddha, you have a conceptual appearance of the Buddha. You're not seeing the Buddha directly with direct mental perception at this point, yeah? Okay. So here, non-conceptuality does not mean that the mind perceives its object directly without the medium of a conceptual appearance. Okay, that's what's usually called non-conceptuality, yeah? Rather, it indicates the mind can stay on the observed object of meditation for as long as we wish because it is free from restlessness and does not conceptualize any other objects. Okay, so it's not with, you know, all the when we have distraction, when we're anger arises or craving arises, there's a conceptual mind. You know, we're thinking about something and we have conceptual image of it. But here, this kind of non-conceptuality, yeah, you don't have that going on because you're not conceptualizing other objects. But your object meditation may be conceptual. Or a conceptual appearance. It's easier to say it that way. Okay, second quality is clarity. So in this context, yeah, clarity means that the mind is free from laxity and the object clearly appears. So clarity is an attribute of the mind. The mind is clear. Yeah, when the mind is clear, the object can clearly appear. Yeah, it isn't that the object changes. Yeah. Okay. And then the third quality of serenity in this context, benefit is benefit, and it means that the bliss of mental and physical pliancy has been attained. Okay? Once serenity has been attained, four afflictions can interfere with maintaining and improving the quality of concentration. So serenity is great and it's a big step, but there's still, you know, four afflictions that can interfere with it, as well as other things that can interfere with it. We'll get into that. So it is important to monitor the mind diligently and avoid falling prey to them. Okay, so here are the four that can easily arise after we attain serenity. Guess what the first one is? Our old friend, attachment. Gee, imagine that. It can still arise, huh? So, but here, it's not attachment to chocolate. It's not attachment to pizza. It's attachment to the pleasure of serenity or whatever level of absorption we have attained that prevents us from cultivating wisdom. Okay, so we've attained serenity or, you know, one of the former formless absorptions. And it's so pleasurable. Who wants to come out of that state? I just want to stay in it. Like the young man who I talk about, who came here and said, I want the bliss. Yeah, he didn't want to peel apples to make applesauce. Yeah, he wanted the bliss. And so I told him where to go. And I don't know what happened when he went there, because probably the teacher there said something similar to what I would say. Okay. But so there's danger of attachment to the pleasurable feeling. Yeah, because we are suckers for pleasure. So if we're not getting our pleasure from chocolate anymore, because there's no craving for sense objects, then, and the pleasure from being in concentration is so much greater than the pleasure of eating chocolate, then, you know, we get attached to that. And that prevents us from cultivating wisdom. So content to remain in blissful concentration, we relinquish the opportunity to realize emptiness. Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, your alarm clock wakes you up, and it's like, it was so relaxing going back to sleep. And I know if I go to work today, you know, I'm meeting with a client, we're going to close this deal, but I want to go back to sleep, clunk, because it's so pleasurable. Yeah, so it's kind of like that. There's something better you can do, like meditate on emptiness, but, you know, you just would rather stay in your blissful concentration. Mm-hmm. Okay, second affliction. Yeah, another favorite one. Arrogance. So arrogance, yeah, thinking that we are superior to others because we have attained meditative absorption. And that distracts us from deepening our concentration and wisdom. Because when we are arrogant about something, we have no interest in improving because we don't think we need to improve because we're already so good. And that's why we're arrogant. Yeah, so you can see arrogance is, it's not a friend, and it's very different than self-confidence. Okay. When we have genuine self-confidence and can evaluate our own behavior and our own motivations, then what other people say to us is not so important, okay? When we are arrogant, what other people say about us is really important, yeah? And when they criticize us, it completely pops the bubble of our arrogance. Yeah. Yeah. And then we either get angry because I'm so wonderful, who is this person to put me down? Or we then say, oh, yeah, actually they're right. I'm really inferior and I can't do this and that. And we put ourselves down. So neither of those is very helpful. Okay, the third affliction that can come up after we've attained, this doesn't mean the no other afflictions. These are the big ones that bug us. Okay, so the third one that can come up after we've attained serenity is ignorance. And here, you know, it's not just the ignorance that doesn't understand karma or the ignorance that doesn't understand emptiness. Here, it's ignorance mistaking deep states of absorption for liberation. And that keeps us bound in samsara. Yeah. So you're in this deep state of absorption. It's very blissful. And you think, now I've attained nirvana. Yeah, it's blissful, I'm concentrated, my mind is calm, I've attained liberation from samsara. Okay. And this is something that the non-Buddhists can get stuck in, as well as the Buddhists. Yeah. So the result of this is especially painful at the time of death, when a meditator expects to attain nirvana without remainder, but instead realizes that they will be reborn in samsara. So it was so blissful. Now when I die, you know, I'm leaving this body. Yeah, so it's that was produced by afflictions. So I'm going to attain nirvana without remainder. The remainder is this body attained due to afflictions. So I'm going to have that and be liberated, and it's going to be great. Yeah. Except it isn't. You know, you die and it's like, no, this isn't nirvana. I'm getting reborn in samsara again. Yeah. And very often it's back in the desire realm with all of the desire realm's craziness. And then the fourth one is, again, our old friend, wrong views. And that obstructs gaining the correct liberating view of emptiness. Okay, so we have serenity. We could move on to really developing insight into emptiness. But our mind's full of wrong views. Yeah, there's still this feeling in our back of the back of our mind of, oh, but God exists. I should... You know, yeah, I want to realize emptiness, but that will enable me to really be devoted to God, you know. So that wrong view is still there. Yeah. Or we have so many different kinds of wrong views, you know. Now, oh, wrong view. If I get just change my object of meditation to blank-mindedness, stop, you know, cease any object and meditate on nothingness will be the realization of emptiness. Again, that's a wrong view. And when people hold that, then they don't learn about emptiness or meditate on emptiness. Okay. So it obstructs gaining the correct liberating view of emptiness. Okay. Interesting, isn't it? What can still arise after you've attained serenity?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So something I'm confused about with this presentation, especially some of the review that you went over, there's a lot of discussion of that virtuous object, and you'll be able to, you know, the afflictions go away temporarily, they're suppressed. But isn't it the case that for some of these non-Buddhists, they're not pursuing these things for a virtuous reason? Mm-hmm. So when the text is focusing on, you know, oh, virtuous this, virtuous that, is that kind of more constrained to talking about the Buddha?
It's talking to us.
Okay.
Assuming that if we've gotten this far, we know we have some bodhicitta attitude in our mind.
Okay. So it isn't the case that someone who has a, like just attachment to the bliss, achieves serenity and suddenly has a virtuous mind.
That they suddenly have a virtuous, can switch their mind and, you know.
But serenity isn't a cause to become more virtuous than you were if your motivation wasn't good.
Well, if your motivation, let's say, was to be free of samsara, then you attain serenity. It increases that motivation of renunciation, which is virtuous. Yeah. So somebody who has a Buddhist aim, that this is why wrong views interfere. Yeah. Because you aren't steered necessarily towards a virtuous object. Yeah. You just want bliss or to see God or to have all sorts of psychic powers, you know? Oh, now let's see, what's Joe Blow thinking about today? Can I read his mind? Yeah. You know, I mean, that's not virtuous, yeah. Okay. You have to remember, I mean, this about Milarepa, you know? Milarepa initially, he was not a Buddhist. He attained serenity, yeah. And he also, you know, some other people had harmed his family. So he used his serenity to give him powers to inflict sickness and injury on those people, and he killed them, even after he had attained serenity, yeah. So his anger had been subdued to attain serenity, but afterwards You know, it's like, oh, people attack my family. I need to, get even and stick up for our honors. So there was attachment and anger. Okay, so this is what Marpa had to work with, and taking him as a student. Okay, so in Shravaka grounds, a Sangha recommends, when you attain the mind of serenity in this way, signs, thoughts, or auxiliary afflictions may appear, manifest, or become the object because of forgetfulness or the fault of the lack of habituation. So we forget our object because we're not super habituated with it. So do not fall immediately under the influence of faults that you have previously observed. Neither recall them nor pay attention to them. So you may have had different faults in your meditation before. Don't go through a review of them now. Okay. Oh, yeah. I remember I used to daydream about being on the beach with Buddha Boy. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had serenity, but oh, that was kind of a nice, break from concentration, Who knows what our crazy mind will do? Okay, so neither recall them nor pay attention to them, these faults in concentration. In this way, because you are neither being mindful of this object nor attending to it, it dissolves. And when it is dispelled, you will settle in the absence of the appearance of these obstructions. So here is the antidote that we sometimes hear people to say to do, even at the beginning, where you just sit there and you don't attend to the affliction. It's there, it's there. But you're not applying an antidote. You're not thinking about it. You're not screaming, ah, there's an affliction in my mind. Okay. So you're neither being mindful of that object nor attending to it. And it goes away. And then, when it is dispelled, you will settle in the absence of the absence of the appearance of these obstructions. So that's an absence, but it's not emptiness. While cultivating the nine stages of sustained attention, and during the first period of time after attaining serenity, the meditation object is a conceptual appearance, perceived by a conceptual mental consciousness. Okay. So, for example, the image of the Buddha. Or if we'll get into it later when we talk about how the Theravadas do it. If they do on the breath, they'll get a little, what's called a nimitta, a little like shiny object appearing to the mind. Okay. So the meditation object is a conceptual appearance perceived by conceptual mental consciousness right after you've attained serenity. As meditation continues and serenity becomes more refined, a point is reached where the object is so vivid that it is known non-conceptually. Okay? At this point, the object is no longer a conceptual appearance of, for example, the Buddha, but a form that is a phenomenal source, a form appearing only to mental consciousness. Okay, so what it doesn't specify here, but my feeling is your object may still be the image of a Buddha, the Buddha, but it's not a conceptual appearance of the Buddha because your concentration is so strong. Now it's a mental perception of the Buddha It's a phenomenal source, a form appearing only to mental consciousness. You remember when we did Dura, collected topics when they go through different kinds of form. So there's a form that appears to mental consciousness. Yeah. Human beings who have attained serenity or higher absorptions do not lose their single-pointed concentration during the break times between meditation sessions. They don't lose it, but it also isn't manifest. So when they say they don't lose it, yeah, that means they don't like go back to where they were before they even started meditating to develop serenity. Yeah, they still have serenity, but it is dormant for that time during the break times. Okay. So they don't lose their single-pointed concentration during the break time between meditation sessions. However, it is not manifest, and their five senses function when they go about their daily activities. Okay? So again, meditation, break time, you're not single-pointed, your senses are functioning. If your senses don't function, you're not going to function. You're going to go to cross the street and you're just going to be like the pedestrians in New York. You start walking across without looking either way to see if a car is coming. Yeah? So that's not what happens. Thank goodness. Okay. However, it is not manifest, and their five senses function when they go about their daily activities. Although their afflictions are weaker due to the power of samadhi, they may still manifest, so practitioners must maintain mindfulness and introspective awareness in all activities. Yeah, so mindfulness, whatever we're doing in the break time, putting our mind on it, and introspective awareness, checking to see if our mind is on what we placed it to, or if we're distracted by restlessness, or the mind is getting lethargic, or laxity is coming. Okay. So during such a retreat, to generate serenity, do mainly stabilizing meditation with a little analytic meditation. Why? Because stabilizing, you're trying to stay on one object. Analytical meditation, you're thinking about something, looking at the object from different, you know, perspectives, thinking about is it permanent, impermanent, whatever, and so on. So your object is changing. Yeah. So when you're trying to develop serenity, most of the time you want to do concentration meditation, not analytic. Yeah. But you may have to do some analytical meditation at the beginning of your session to identify the object you're meditating on. So, for example, if it's the image of the Buddha, the analytical meditation is noticing the details of, you know, what the Buddha's body looks like and so on. Okay. Or if you're meditating on love or compassion, then you have to think about sentient beings, cultivate that feeling of, you know, seeing them as affectionable, worthy of affection. Yeah. And letting arise, love arise in your mind. Okay, so that has, you have to do some analytical at the beginning. So a Sangha instructs, at that time of cultivating serenity, this concentration attends to an image without discursive thought, and it exclusively focuses mindfulness one-pointed on the object. It does not examine it, classify it, investigate it, ponder it, or analyze it. Okay, so you're not thinking, is this something that has the nature of dukkha? You're not thinking, is it permanent or impermanent? Does it have a self or not have a self? You're not thinking about or analyzing any of that. Yeah, and if you're meditating on the image of the Buddha, you're not analyzing, what shade of gold are his robes? And, the statue I was looking at, there was a pattern in the robes, but our robes don't have patterns. How come when they paint pictures of the Buddha, his robes, his cloth always has some design in it? But that isn't that, attachment to wanting to look special and have nice, attractive robes. You're not thinking any of that, okay? It's amazing what our mind can do, the things we can get off on, Okay. So a sangha indicates that the practice of serenity does not involve analytical activity. Kamala Shila agrees and says in the stages of meditation, the nature of serenity is nothing more than a one-pointed mind. One-pointed mind is samadhi, yeah? This is the general characteristic of all meditative serenity, okay? So there's different states of meditative serenity, yeah? The way we say here so far, it sounds like attaining serenity is a stage. You go through the 9 stages of sustained attention, then mental pliancy, physical pliancy, bliss of physical pliancy, bliss of mental pliancy. Then I attain serenity. Hooray. Serenity is a quality. It's not a stage in this process. It's a quality that we're cultivating. So serenity is not a stage of concentration. It is a quality that pervades all meditative absorptions, so that when even you go higher, you attain meditative absorptions of, any of the 4 form realms, any of the 4 formless realms, they all have serenity as a factor. Okay? Some people erroneously believe that any meditation that lacks analysis and discursive thought must be meditation on emptiness, but this is not the case. It could be meditation on nothingness. Okay, meditation on blank-mindedness. This whole big debate that they had in Tibet, okay, at the end of the 8th century, 9th century, between Mohan, yeah, there are different names for him. He's a Chinese abbot and Kamala Shila. Yeah, which is interesting. In Tibetan history, this debate is a big thing. As far as I understand, the Chinese have no record of it. Yeah, they do? Oh, really? Because I was talking with Jen Courage and somebody, and they...
I don't know, within Chinese Buddhism, maybe it's not important, but the best historical source is the 8th century Chan history that records. And Geshe Thabke talked about it because it's been translated into Tibetan.
Oh, back translated, okay.
Yeah, and it's also the one that records, apparently, the ordination of the first nun by He Shang Mo He Yan. And then that's the source that Alex Berzin was citing on his website, wondering, could she have been a bhikshuni or not? Anyway, it's a long story, but that source, the Chan Chinese source, records the first first ordination of a nun and her 30 friends or relatives.
And a first ordination in China?
No, Tibet.
In Tibet?
From the Chinese perspective.
I see.
Yeah. And then it says, oh, isn't she just like Mahaprajapati Gotami? So people read that as thinking, could he have given the Bhikshuni ordination? But it's not clear. Yeah.
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 He
Anyway.
could have. Why
Yeah,
not?
he
He
didn't.
had the lineage. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. So when, after attaining serenity, concentration is conjoined with the aspiration for liberation, it becomes a path to liberation. That, in fact, is the demarcation of entering the first path, the path of accumulation of the Shravaka or solitary realizer vehicle, when you adjoin serenity with the aspiration for liberation. Okay. When it is conjoined with bodhicitta, it becomes the Mahayana path leading to awakening.
So, with serenity, that makes those minds uncontrived or spontaneous.
Say it again.
So, with serenity,
Yeah, talk
that
into the mic.
when you attain serenity, that makes those minds, renunciation and bodhicitta, spontaneous.
No, I think you have I don't know the degree of spontaneity, of let's say your renunciation, but the serenity is when you have serenity and renunciation together, then you've entered the Shravaka path of accumulation, as far as I understand. Okay, that doesn't matter. It doesn't mean, oh, I have renunciation of samsara. I can tell you the three kinds of dukkha, the six kinds of dukkha, and the eight kinds. I don't want any of those, Oh, but now I have serenity. I don't think it means that kind of renunciation. You have some kind of strong feeling for it. Okay. And similar for bodhicitta. Yeah. Although it could, I don't know, it could be that maybe you have those spontaneous and then you develop serenity very soon after you enter the path of accumulation. I don't know, you can look it up somewhere or do it and then tell us. Okay. Yeah. Now then you can go, what I studied in that book a long time ago, 15 eons ago, I don't know. I better tell them that that needs to be revised. Okay. But what this paragraph is emphasizing is that having serenity is very important for your understanding becoming either a Shravaka, one of the Shravakas, or one of the Bodhisattvas, and becoming a path. Yeah. Okay, then the next section is about the diagram. Yeah. So I was of two minds whether to pull out the diagram or refer to the book and have you trace it. Or if you just want to do this on your own and we continue. Have you looked at the diagram on your own? Should we go through it? Or, yeah, you want to go through it? Okay. So it's on page 166. Yeah. Okay. So you'll notice on the diagram, page 166, there's all sorts of little numbers. So, this is going to explain what the number's about. Okay. So, the six bends in the path, if you start at the bottom, and then one, two, three, four, five, six. Yeah. The six bends in the path represent the six powers. Remember the six powers? Okay. You remember what are they? What? Hearing, reflection, Mindfulness, introspective awareness, effort, and familiarity. Okay, so those six helped us to gain serenity. So at each of the curves represents one of those six, probably because that is what is, oh, there it is going on for you, the main thing that's going on in your meditation. Okay, so the first bend down at the bottom there, yeah, you see the number one. That's the monastic starting out. Okay, that's you with your robes flowing all over the place. Yeah, so that first bend, yeah, signifies the power of hearing, spiritual mentor's instructions on how to cultivate serenity. So this is study, yeah? Then look at number two. It's not very far away from number one. So that's the first stage of sustained attention, placing the mind, and that's attained by the power of hearing instructions. Okay, look at the number three. That's the rope, yeah, that he has, the meditator has, and he's trying to rope in his object of meditation. So that's the power of mindfulness. Look at number four. Number four is high. It's a little bit above, yeah. So he's holding, the monk is holding a hook, yeah? So the taming hook represents the power of introspective awareness, okay? So he has the rope, that's mindfulness, the hook, to hook his mind back, the power of introspective awareness. Look at number five, okay, it's down there. So the flame, that's a flame. Yeah. So the flame is found from this point until the seventh stage. Yeah. After which it is no longer present. So you can see the flame keeps going up there. Yeah. It decreases in size, indicating the decreasing amount of effort needed to apply mindfulness and introspective awareness. Okay, so the flame is the effort to, you know, generate mindfulness and introspective awareness. Okay, then number six, yeah, you see the elephant? He represents the mind, and its black color indicates laxity. So laxity, lethargy, that's where we're at the beginning. Okay, look just in front of the elephant. Yeah, so the elephant is the mind, yeah? It's black because of laxity, because you're falling asleep. The monkey is in front of it because it's dragging the mind to its distractions. And it is also black in color, indicating restlessness in particular. You know, you're thinking about objects of attachment. The monk is chasing the elephant. Yeah, so the monk is the meditator. The elephant is the mind. The monk is chasing the elephant and the monkey, indicating that he has little control over laxity and distraction that plague his mind. So that kind of describes us, yeah? Huh? Yeah, we're getting to number eight. We haven't gotten to it yet. Okay, now number eight. This bend represents the power of reflection. Okay, it's the second power. The power of reflection on the meditative object, which leads to the second stage of sustained attention. And number nine, just ahead on the path, is the second stage, continual placement, and it is attained when the length of focus on the meditation object has increased. Okay, so you're not at samadhi, but you can stay on the object 2 seconds instead of one. Yeah. You still have the fire burning. Yeah. Okay, then number 11. Yeah. The elephant is it? Oh, 10, sorry. 10 is exposure to the five sense objects, incites restlessness, and hinders concentration. So you can see near the 10, it's a bowl of fruit, something. Yeah, jewels, maybe. A bowl of something. So it incites attachment to sense objects. Okay, number 11, yeah. The monkey still leading the elephant. Yeah, the elephant's still black, so is the monkey. But one of the elephant's ears is white. Yeah. So that's number 11. The elephant now walks instead of runs. So the mind is beginning to calm down. And the elephant gradually turns white, representing increased clarity on the object and increased focus on it. Okay. So mind's getting clearer, mind's getting more stable. Then number 12, the bend represents the power of mindfulness, the third power, which leads to attaining both the third and the fourth stages. So that's what's prevalent there. That's number 12. Number 13 is the third stage, repeated placement, and that's attained with the power of mindfulness. So what's going 13? Yeah. So he still has his rope, still has his hook. The meditator has lassoed the elephant with the rope and can bring his attention back to the meditation object when it has been interrupted by coarse laxity or restlessness. Yeah. So at this, you know, beginning stages, we don't really have manifest restlessness and manifest subtle restlessness or manifest subtle laxity, because we have both of those gross. So when they're gross, you know, the subtle aspects are buried under the grossness. Okay, so number 14, yeah, the hair now represents subtle laxity. So you see the little on number 14 sitting on the back of the elephant. There's a little bunny. Yeah, dawa. Yeah. So now the meditator can distinguish between gross and subtle laxity. Yeah. Okay. Then 15. Yeah. The animals looking backwards, indicating that the mind is gaining strength over the faults and represents the mind ability to return to the meditation object after recognizing mental wandering. Okay, so the monkey and the elephant are both looking back. They're reminiscing about their greater days when they were stronger, because now they're becoming weaker. Okay, because the mind is gaining strength. Okay, then number 16, yeah, the fourth stage, the fourth stage, close placement is attained. The meditator is able to bring his attention back to the meditation object more quickly. Okay, That was 16. Yeah, so he's really holding on to the elephant, and he's also closer to the elephant. Okay, then number 17. This bend represents the power of introspective awareness, yeah, which leads to the attainment of the fifth and sixth stages. So that's that bend. That's 17. 18. Restlessness's ability to affect the mind is curbed. Yeah, because look, now the monkey is walking behind the elephant. Before, it was in front of the elephant leading the mind. Now the mind is starting to lead it. You can see the bunny rabbit on top of the elephant's back a little bit better. He's turning white there. So, okay, then above, before we get to 19, yeah. So 19 is, oh yeah, the monkey is sitting in the tree, gathering fruit from the tree to the side of the meditation path, represents the distinction between virtuous thoughts that arise when doing stabilizing meditation and at other times. The ones that arise during stabilizing meditation must be suppressed because they distract the meditator from the meditation object, whereas virtuous thoughts that arise at other times are to be encouraged. Okay, so that's 19, the monkey gathering the fruit from the tree. Yeah. So it's this distinction between virtuous thoughts that arise when doing stabilization, which you don't want to follow, and those virtuous thoughts that arise in break time, which are you want to encourage. Okay. Then 20, that's above the elephant's head. The meditator is no longer chasing the wild elephant of the mind, but is now leading it. Yeah. So the meditator, he's no longer out of breath. Come back here. But he's leading the mind. That's 20. Then 21. Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't finished all of 20. The meditator is no longer chasing the wild elephant of the mind, but is now leading it. Laxity and restlessness have decreased, but not disappeared. Okay, then 21, the fifth stage, taming, is attained, and coarse laxity and coarse restlessness are no longer problems. Yeah. The mind is more controlled, although the meditator must goad the elephant. Still needs effort. Yeah. You can see the meditator poking the elephant, dragging it along still. Okay. But you can see the fire is smaller now. Okay, so that's 21. 22 is the sixth stage, pacifying. That's attained, and all resistance to or dislike for single-pointed meditation is gone. Wow. Okay. The hair, which is now subtle laxity, is gone. Hopped off to Never Never Land. That's 22. Yeah, so you can see that the meditator is in front of the elephant now. He's not, hooking it. He's not pulling it with the rope. Yeah, he's just walking along. Okay, that's 22. Then 23. This bend represents the power of effort, which leads to attaining the seventh and eighth stages. 24, the seventh stage, thoroughly pacifying, is attained. It is now difficult for subtle laxity and subtle restlessness to arise, And if they do, they can be easily eliminated with a small amount of effort. So the monkey stands behind the meditator and pays homage to him. The restless arma, the restless mind bows down to the meditator. Yeah. Okay, you can still see, you know, the bottom of the elephant's feet is dark there. His back, his tush is dark. That's 24. Then 25, the elephant is completely white. Okay, so the black must be, he walked through some mud. It's not him. Okay, so the elephant is completely white. And the monkey is no longer present. Wow. The monkey jumped in a tree and is living happily ever after. And that symbolizes that by applying a little mindfulness and introspective awareness at the beginning of the meditation session, the meditator can enter an uninterrupted state of single-pointed concentration in which laxity, restlessness, and distractions do not have the power to interrupt concentration. So the eighth stage is near. That's 25. Wait a minute, could you speak into the mic and tell me where you're reading?
In the middle of number 25, mm-hmm. It says that, let's see, the third line down at the end, it says the meditator can enter an interrupted state of single-pointed concentration. Mm-hmm. Is that a typo?
Okay, he is at seventh stage. Let's look at the seventh stage. Seventh stage can have both interrupted and uninterrupted. Yeah, if you look at the chart on page 202, yeah. Or actually, it looks like seventh stage has interrupted, and it's the eighth stage that goes into uninterrupted. Okay, so can concentrate fairly well, but it's not single-pointedly. It can still get interrupted. Yeah. Okay, so that was 25, right? But the eighth stage is clear. Okay, so then 26. Yeah. The eighth stage, making single-pointed. Okay, so that's why it was interrupted on the seventh stage. It wasn't single-pointed. Eighth stage, making single-pointed, is attained. Laxity and restlessness are not able to interrupt concentration. They were before. Yeah. So the focus is uninterrupted. At the beginning of the session, the meditator can immediately apprehend the meditation object and can continuously maintain concentration on it. But that's the eighth stage. It's not even the ninth, not even serenity. Okay. Okay, then 26. That was 26. Then 27, we're at another bend in the road. Okay. This bend represents the power of complete familiarity through which the ninth stage is attained. And at that time, you see that the elephant's lying down. The meditator is, you know, sitting nicely in meditation, relaxed. Okay, so that's 27. Then 28, the ninth stage, placed in equipoise, is attained. The elephant rests besides the meditator, yeah, who sits at ease. The mind effortlessly stays on the meditation object without any interruption during the entire session. A rainbow streams from the meditator's heart. Yeah, he's happy. Yeah, see the rainbow that is, you know, going to the right, and it goes all the way to the other side of the page. Okay, so that was 28. Where is 29? There he is flying in the sky. Okay, so the meditator rides the elephant along the rainbow path en route to serenity. The meditator experiences the bliss of physical and mental pliancy. Yeah. So he's attained the ninth stage. He's getting, you know, physical, mental pliancy, physical pliancy, and now the bliss of both of those. Okay. Then 30, serenity is attained. Hello. 31, mental joy is present, and you put your attainment on Facebook so that everybody knows and can rejoice in your virtue. Yeah. Then you see 32. Yeah, now he's riding on top of the elephant. So the monk rides the completely pacified elephant. By attaining the union of serenity and insight with emptiness as the object, the monk holds the sword of wisdom. Ignorance, the root of samsara, is now in the process of being cut. It's not cut all at once. It's a whole process. Okay, but he's holding Manjushri's sword. And then 33... with extremely powerful mindfulness and wisdom, represented by the flames, the meditator continues to meditate on emptiness. With this meditation informed by bodhicitta, he eradicates all defilements from the mind. So whenever I see it, you know, here the elephant has switched directions. It makes me think, you know, on the Mahayana path, you meditate, you know, to really purify your own mind. You get serenity. Now you're starting to meditate on emptiness. But your bodhicitta is very strong. You're turning back to look at sentient beings and thinking of sentient beings. And, you know, the bodhicitta motivation is what pushes you to continue to develop serenity and then insight onto emptiness. But that's just my thought, how I look at it. Okay, so that is the end of chapter 7. And we will start chapter 8 in 2 weeks. Yeah.